나서 This will be actually short. I'm not going to go on for 45 minutes or whatever. As we are now clearly beginning to anticipate, or have been anticipating for some time now, venturing out of our little Pure Land into the rest of the world that likes to think of itself as real, we'll have our protection from the inside to maintain our equilibrium, composure, the clarity, the sanity of the mind. Protection from the inside, as each of us as an individual, is shamatha, right? You remember, and that was the Buddha's own image, that the shamatha was the bodyguard for the minister of vipassana, remember? So from the inside, for just you as an individual, wherever you happen to be, your protection from the inside is the shamatha. But of course, we're not just solitary individuals, we're not just individuals, we are indeed social creatures. Our lives are interconnected with those sentient beings around us. And so we engage. We engage with the lovely people here. We'll engage with lovely people elsewhere, some of them not always manifesting in such a lovely fashion. Right? In which case, in terms of our interrelationship with others, with the world of sentient beings around us, including dogs, you know, and human beings and all other kind of creatures, our protection in terms of our interrelationships, our protection from the outside, so to speak, like our skin, is the four immeasurables. The four immeasurables. And they really can be, I love the metaphor, that they can really be like our four best friends, our four constant companions. So for wherever we go, whether it's to our own family, our dear ones, our loved ones, or having to deal with the most difficult people in our lives, or the general public and so forth, wherever we are, having those four... as your constant companions, your best friends. Well, we all know about friendship. We know that friendships don't just happen by themselves. They need to be cultured. We cultivate friendships, and then we sustain friendships by keeping them alive, nurturing them, maintaining them, you know, keeping the relationships. And so as it is with friends, so it is with the four immeasurables. You don't just learn them and say, oh yeah, 3 years ago I used to practice them. They're really good. That's like a friendship that's grown cold, right? So maintaining the friendship, maintaining the relationship, the intimacy, the sense of familiarity that, you know, we had 10 different ways of practicing the four immeasurables, right? And having them all very familiar, like a piano piece that you can play blindfolded in the middle of the night. Yeah, oh yeah, I know that piece, you know? And so the four immeasurables, while as soon as you hit Phuket Airport, you may find your shamatha getting a little bit thin, you'll have plenty of opportunities for the four immeasurables right there, immediately, right? There's no reason that our cultivation of the four immeasurables should in any way taper off. If we do, it's just because we're not interested. There's no motivation. But there's nothing from outside that would say, oh, you got into that situation. Oh, people can't practice four immeasurables there. You can't practice compassion there. Oh, equanimity, no possibility of equanimity there. Loving kindness? No, you can't practice loving kindness for those people. You know, there isn't any. But whatever situation comes up, and I mean really without exception, take the archetypes. Think of a Nazi. Think of Al Qaeda. I won't give any more examples. Think of Mother Teresa. Think of Nelson Mandela and so forth. Whoever you think of, whatever comes up. Compassion, empathetic joy, loving kindness, equanimity. One of them is going to be appropriate. I don't think there's going to be any situation in the whole bandwidth of our relationship with sentient beings, and even if you think of Dalai Lama, Buddhas, Nagarjuna, and so forth, empathetic joy is kind of obvious, you know? So I think there may be a couple of people here who've never heard one of my all-time favorite metaphors, and if that's the case, then I will share it with you, because I've not made it explicit in this retreat. Show of hands, if there's even one, you're going to get it. And that is, has anyone not heard the metaphor of the chariot drawn by the four horses? Okay, that's enough. That's more than one, more than two. Well, I love it. I love it. And this is drawing, when I refer so often to the four immeasurables as not only being four qualities of the heart, but there's so much wisdom there. I mean, just flat out intelligent wisdom, sharp, intuitive, sort of Manjushri type of wisdom, right in the four immeasurables. Well, here's part of that wisdom, and it comes from a text from the Nyingma tradition, and I'm almost certain, but I've not been able to ascertain this, that it was from one of Longchen Rachamba's commentaries on the four immeasurables. But I've not been able to trace it but I know it comes from the Tibetan tradition and also almost certainly in Nyingma. And that is how within the four, one of the four is going to balance another of the four when it goes astray. Do you remember, Jacob? Was it a Lonchenpa text?
It's the
Sinyinga Sotho. Oh, fantastic. Well, then it's not only from a Tibetan text, it's from one of the great classics in all of Tibetan literature. But I like an image. I love images. You've given a number of them by now, and here's one of my favorite images. As we're venturing forth, often we speak of, you know, so they'll use Shravakayana, or if we want to use the pejorative, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana. In all of these cases, yana, of course, means a vehicle like a carriage. So if we think of ourselves as venturing forth from this place out into wherever we're going for the rest of our lives, from here until enlightenment, then we're venturing forth in the carriage of our lives. Right? And what I'm suggesting here is these four immeasurables from here until enlightenment can be for like the four mighty steeds, the four mighty stallions or what have you, but it's not gender specific, four mighty steeds, chargers, horses that are pulling the chariot. Four, and they are loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. So imagine it, if you will, a fine chariot, and then pulled by these four mighty chargers, and out in front is loving kindness and compassion. Out in front to the left, loving kindness. Out in front to the right, compassion. Those are your two lead horses. Wherever you're going, loving kindness and compassion are drawing you there. They're at the tip. They're at the forefront, right? Now, immediately behind this mighty steed of loving kindness is equanimity. And immediately behind compassion is empathetic joy. Empathetic joy. So just imagine, obviously it's symbolic. But now we'll see how it fits together. All right? So these four mighty chargers are then leading you onwards to your destination, finally, of really completely awakening. But of course, sometimes they falter. Sometimes they falter. Maybe they fall asleep or they stumble or what have you. And so on occasion, should loving kindness stumble? Okay, it's a mighty horse, but once in a while it gets sleepy or tired or something like that. And this mighty charger there on the left in the front stumbles, and it falls into the false facsimile of loving kindness. What is that? Self-centered attachment. Self-centered attachment. And so clearly, that's if that horse starts to lead you off to self-centered attachment, that's no longer on the great highway, the Lamboche. It's no longer on the great highway, the Bodhisattva path to enlightenment. That's on the path to more samsara. Around and around in a circle it goes. So there it is. Loving kindness was trying its best, but it falters and it falls into self-centered attachment. But right behind it is the great charger of equanimity. And equanimity is there as loving kindness's best friend, protector, guardian, watching his back. As we say, you know, in English, I'm watching your back. Don't worry, I'm watching your back, which means I'm taking care of you. If anything goes wrong, I'm right here for you. So equanimity is charging along, but if he sees loving kindness starting to stumble into self-centered attachment, then out comes equanimity to help you. I'll bring you back. I'll bring you back. This will restore you. This will get you out of your self-centered attachment. Attend to all sentient beings. Everyone a subject. Everyone as worthy of happiness as yourself. And so therefore, and then loving kindness says, thanks, buddy. And gets back on track. Now, we all know this. I think probably everyone here knows this, that as we cultivate compassion, or simply compassion arises spontaneously on occasion, sometimes it goes astray and it falls into its near enemy, which is? No. Compassion. Compassion. Despair is exactly the word. Grief, despair, hopelessness. That whole package. But probably the single best word is despair, which is sad, but it's also hopeless. And we know it's so possible, especially in this great experiment of modernity, where I just checked, 68 people died in Cuba just within a couple of hours, airplane crashed. And I was just thinking, 68 people, and then all the family and the loved ones, and how much grief, one airplane crash. You know, I just checked, and there it was. Oh, so much suffering. One airplane. But for the people, the loved ones of the people on that airplane, this is like the end of the world. You know? And that's one airplane. This is 7 billion people on the planet. That's 168 people, you know. But just that, if you really attend to them as if they're your own family, 68 people just died, you know. No survivors. Crashed, flame. Everybody died, you know. So humanity's never been exposed to this much sadness, this much tragedy in all of humanity. This is very, very recent. So it's especially easy for us as we develop compassion to feel, yeah, but Alan, what can you do about those people? What can I do for the families? What can I do? Nothing. And then, oh, then sadness. Well, what do we do? Who's going to save? Who's going to save compassion when it falters and strays into grief and despair? The charger right behind. Empathetic joy. Yes, this is a tragedy. Certainly is a tragedy. But think how much joy there is also in the world, and how much virtue, and how much kindness. And how much kindness is with this, even that tragedy, which is 100% tragedy. But how much kindness is that going to elicit? How many friends and loved ones will come around the families who've just lost a loved one and bring out the best of them, the caring, the affection, the warmth, gathering around, soothing and comforting? That's good. That's all good. Right? So then we go to empathetic joy. Yes, it's a great sadness, but there is also so much good, so much virtue, so much kindness and joy in the world. And so empathetic joy says, compassion, I'm watching your back. And if you stumble, I will save you. And I'll bring you back on track. Right? But now, of course, sometimes, and then we come back, there's loving kindness. Right behind him is what? Equanimity. Sometimes equanimity also stumbles. Stumbles, and it just goes into aloof indifference, like, yeah, burnt out. I just can't care anymore. I've had it. I mean, I'm tired. I'm pooped. I'm finished. I'm flacked. I'm in equanimity that's sterile. And so who's going to save equanimity? When it's near enemy, of course, aloof indifference. I've already given that one away. Well, there's compassion up there on the front right. It says, I'm looking over my shoulder at you. I'm keeping my eye on you. And if you back there, if you stumble, I will save you. So compassion looks over the shoulder, over the left shoulder, back at equanimity. If you fall into aloof indifference, don't you worry. I'll save you. Because if you start attending to the suffering in the world, you just can't remain aloof. Who can? Anybody who sees a child who's crying and crying and crying, who can look at them and say, well, not my kid? That'd be a very rare individual, or a child who's just been wounded, or a child who's terrified, and then a bigger child who's terrified, and a 45-year-old child who's terrified. You know, just open your heart, and who can be indifferent when you see people really suffering? Indifference has to vanish. If you really attend and let that what you attend to become real for you. So compassion says, don't worry. I won't let you stumble for long. I'll take care of you. And then we have the final one over there, empathetic joy. Sometimes empathetic joy just gets to be a bit of a goof-off, right? Frivolous, hedonic pleasure, just getting caught up in samsara, trying to just have fun, right? But basically losing the scent, losing track, straying off. And of course, we can always beat it with impermanence or beat it with recollections on the 6 types of suffering and the 3 types of suffering and the 8 types of suffering. And there's karma. And, you know, we can really beat it back into shape, which is one way of getting it back into shape. It's true. But a pretty gentle approach is loving kindness, saying, look, I'm looking over my right shoulder at you. And if you just start going for hedonic pleasure, I'm going to bring you some wisdom here. You're going there because you want to find happiness. But if you really want to find happiness, why don't you cultivate loving kindness for yourself and really reflect what really will bring you happiness? Will it just be a whole string of hedonic pleasures forever and you'll just be happily ever after because you'll never get old, never get sick, and never die, and never meet adversity? You think that's really going to happen? So I'm going to bring you loving kindness and bring you wisdom that in your pursuit of happiness, you really find happiness. Loving kindness, I will look over you, empathetic joy, and save you when you stray. So in this way, there's this utterly magnificent internal balancing among the four. If any goes through, you don't have to go outside. You don't have to outsource. It's all insourced. The false facsimiles are there, but the remedies are all there within this matrix. It's quite extraordinary. So final note before we jump in. And that is, people who meditate people who are cultivating the four immeasurables are not the only ones. It's not only in the context of that that sometimes self-centered attachment arises. Right? It's not only people who are practicing Dharma or meditating who sometimes fall into despair, or fall into aloof indifference, or fall into just hedonic frivolity. So this can come up at any time for anyone. And so there they are, these four immeasurables, there to rescue us. So I mentioned this morning, cognitively speaking, sometimes we may feel really stressed out, we may feel just scattered, we may feel quite balanced, whatever it may be, and then we choose among the different shamatha methods to see what is most appropriate, that will be suitable, that won't be frustrating, but will not be too slack, not so easy that you feel, oh, I could do this with my, you know, I could do this in my sleep. In fact, I am doing this in my sleep, you know. That we find the right shamatha method, that we're always there pushing the envelope, going a bit further on the path. And that takes some wisdom, but now we have a nice selection, 10 minimum of different modes of shamatha, right? And then for the afternoon sessions, and of course for the rest of our lives, at any time, should we, then we do this affective assessment of just, well, how's the heart? Where is it tilting? Is it going more towards self-centered detachment? Is it going towards despair, listlessness, apathy, indifference? Is it going towards frivolity and just getting totally caught up in hedonic pleasures and samsara? Where is it drifting? And then to balance out and say, ah, okay, today it's 4:49. Yeah, I think loving kindness. You know, whatever it may be, and then apply it in. Okay? So that's that. So take your own, diagnose yourself, take your own pulse, choose your own method. We will actually have a silent session. Then release all appearances and objects of the mind. And let your awareness rest in its own place, illuminating its own nature. Oh, good. So, Mary, would you like to make an announcement? It's not on.
I did check out the movie, The Oracle, and I found out that it's not available for us because the store on the online website is closed until August 1st, and it doesn't tell what year they're talking about. So anyway, I did find out, though, that you can go on that website and you can take a look at the clip. There's a demo clip that's about 2 minutes, which is fascinating, and it really shows exactly what Alan talked about. You get to see the Oracle person in action. And so you might want to check that out. And the website is called allinonefilms.com, and the director's name is David Cherniak. And then the other thing that you will find very interesting is there was a little bit about these people who are oracles. Apparently, they don't live very long. They only live to be about 50 years old, and they develop all kinds of physical symptoms you wouldn't want to have. Like, they had an interview with a young woman, and she had joint pain. And so if you ever see a want ad for an oracle, you might want to pass that by. That's not a good job.
Yeah. It's entirely an act of altruism. And yeah, so it's not available for us then. Okay, I thought perhaps David could just put it on our website and we could download it. Did you write to him? Write to him. Yeah, write to him on my behalf. He was here for the full 8-week retreat in the spring. He's a very close friend, and he might just be able to put it up for our private viewing and then take it off again. So check that out. Yeah, good. Jenny. I think I found there's a note from here, Maria, but after Maria left, then I tried just more slowly pulling the photo out of a Word file, and I was able to succeed. So if you give me a list of the names of the people who wouldn't mind having their photos compared, give it to me. I'll see what I can do. Okay? Good. So there's not a whole lot here, but I see one is certainly pertaining to practice. So I'm going to do the practice ones first and then go to more theoretical ones after. So in the context of settling the mind, I found myself wanting to practice compassion for my mind and did. If you think there is something about this that would be helpful to talk about the group, please do so, or we can discuss it. Well, we did discuss it. I met with this person today. Again, this is a subtle but not an insignificant point, and that is, from the Buddhist perspective, there's no point in directing compassion towards any... I'll rephrase that. We direct compassion only towards sentient beings. We don't direct compassion towards mental states, or to rocks, or to mental afflictions, or to virtues, or clouds, or anything else. And so we direct compassion if the mind on occasion becomes really troubled. Maybe it's inundated by anger, resentment, anxiety, misery, or what have you. Direct your compassion to yourself. May I be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. But you don't, if somebody got an illness, Paula got an illness, a skin rash, I wouldn't say, oh, skin rash, may you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. It doesn't make any sense. The skin rash is a cause of suffering. So, Paula, may you be free of the skin rash. Okay? So, compassion is always directed towards sentient beings. Hola, so. So, here's, when practicing awareness of awareness and having my attention come back to the knower, it seems like there was some activity in some medium close to my head. I wonder if this medium is prana that extends outside the body. Is it what Westerners call the aura? I can't speak of the aura. I mean, there is a word for aura in Tibetan. It's ukor, which literally means simply a circle of light. And you see it in virtually all of the tankas, Buddha Shakyamuni and pretty much everybody else. And the peaceful deities are surrounded by a circle of gentle life, and the wrathful ones by flames, you know, bonfire. But could it be prana? Yeah, prana does. Excuse me. Prana does extend it beyond the body, but an awareness of awareness. Bear in mind, in awareness of awareness, you just don't take any interest in any appearances to awareness of any kind. Even if a Buddha should appear to you, say, "Rain check. I'll see you after the session." Right. I might even make offerings. You have something to offer, but I'm sure you understand. Right now, I'm really busy, you know? And this is, I just read this recently. It was in one of the texts that I translated. And then I saw that's, Gyatso Rinpoche told me the same thing when I was in retreat, doing a very intensive 6-month retreat on settling the mind. And he made this statement, Alan, when you're settling the mind in its natural state, even if 1,000 maras should come to assault you, they cannot harm you. And even if 1,000 Buddhas should come and bless you, there's no blessing from them. They're just appearances to the mind. They're just appearances to the mind. And I'm publishing about 4 books next year, and one of them wanted to have a kind of endorsement blessing from Gyatso Rinpoche because it's related to teachings I've received from him. And he came back, my revered guru, and said, "I don't give any blessings. I have no blessings to give. The only source of blessing is your own Buddha nature." So there it is. So if you look at a tanka, or if you have a very powerful experience with some great, truly great teacher, like His Holiness Dalai Lama or Karmapa, and so forth, you receive blessing. It's wonderful. But do you really think it's coming from an appearance? Do you think it's really coming from some other mind stream that's entirely separate from your own? Maybe not. Shuku Nyakchik, there's but one Buddha nature. There's but one Dharmakaya. So it's absolutely marvelous that there are holy places, blessed places. This is marvelous. And I take it very seriously. And certainly can there be blessing by being in the presence of a truly, you know, realized being, a person who's really realized deep compassion, bodhicitta. Unquestionably, yes. But is the blessing really being transferred through space? Is it really coming from one place to another? Or is being in that place with that person, what have you, kindling, arousing something from deep inside you? The Dzogchen perspective is pretty clear. So, when you're practicing awareness of awareness, even though other appearances will arise, until you're very far along in the path, don't deliberately give any attention to them. Let them be and just sustain your awareness of awareness itself. Okay. Ah, here's one, again, a bit pretty close to practice, and that is, if prana is a link between mind and matter, in the Buddhist tradition, unequivocally, yes. That's not my speculation or an opinion. Quoting Buddhism, definitely yes. Do we sense it both in both our mental and tactile fields? It's an interesting question. Do we sense it in the tactile fields? Definitely yes. Do you experience it in a purely mental, that is, what we experience in the tactile, do we also experience mentally? And the answer is, of course, yes. Mental goes everywhere. Mental is the monkey that jumps around through all the six windows. But do we experience prana in a purely mental? It's a good question. My intuition would say not. My intuition would say not. And the reason is prana is physical. It's not material, but it is physical. And the mental is not physical. The substrate is not physical. Nothing that you encounter in a dream is physical. It's all purely appearances of mind, immaterial, non-physical. So I suspect that prana is detected in the tactile. But this is actually the first time I've really thought about that. So that's my guess now. Could be wrong. Could be wrong. Is Brett here? I'm looking for Brett. I'm not seeing. Oh, there you are. Sneaky guy, used to be over there. Shapeshifter. Okay. And I'll read the rest later. Yeah, good. But I will read the rest later. So, narrowing it down here. Here's a long one. I'll read the long one first. If I've read a few accounts of near-death experiences, by the way, the best person that I know in that regard, I mean, I've heard him speak, and he was impressive. And no nonsense, no new age, no fluffy, just, boy, he was like as strict as a chemist and as non-emotional and just objective and just critical, sharp. I thought he was a really good scientist. I think he is a really good scientist. I met him, Tony Karam, and I invited him to a meeting, to a conference we organized in Mexico City several years back on death and dying. His name is Bruce Grayson. Bruce Grayson, and he's at the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. He's very good, and he is a very gifted speaker. And he spoke about near-death experiences in this conference. We were all impressed. In fact, Tony and I spoke at the conference, a couple of other people did as well. Tony and I both came out of that conference feeling Bruce Grayson was the best speaker. He was better than I was. And the other ones were excellent. There were no duds, but Bruce was really, he was really good. So if you want to just check out background information, he's very sharp, and he's made this a central focus of his research. So, Bruce Grayson, G-R-E-Y-S-O-N, Bruce Grayson, Division of Perceptual Studies. And there's the single tome is a large, big, fat, dense book that provides the most compelling evidence that would challenge and, to my mind, completely torpedo the materialistic view of mind-brain is a book called The Irreducible Mind. Irreducible Mind, and it's by a whole team of researchers, all of them there at the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia. It's Jim Tucker, the protege of Ian Stevenson, Bruce Grayson is among them, and two or three other people. And it's kind of like a Visuddhimagga. I mean, it's really dense, it's got lots and lots of data, it's critical, it's scientific, and it's not just a bunch of dry facts, they give a theory. It's not meant to be light reading, and it isn't, but it's very good science. And to refute the whole book and come out and say, you see, scientific materialism is true and the mind is just a function of the brain, that would have to be one very brilliant work, because this is not frivolous research. So I've read a few accounts of near-death experiences, including the story you shared yesterday about the woman undergoing brain surgery. Her name, by the way, her pseudonym, because they tried to protect her identity, is Pam Reynolds. The part about the doctor flapping his wings actually came from a different person's account. Could be, I do sometimes conflate memories. I could be, and you may be right. Show me. I'm not saying you're wrong, but I try to be careful there. And I heard Bruce Grayson give a presentation on her. He spoke about it. And then I watched the National Geographic. I have not read the book. There's a whole book on that account. So you may very well, when you say this, I'm sure you're not, whoever's saying it, I'm sure you're not frivolous, but I would like to be corrected, but know that you really are correcting me. So if you can give me the source, I'd appreciate that. I looked it up today for sure. It was a man named Al Sullivan who witnessed the chicken dance during his open heart surgery. It could be, of course, there were two. Quack, 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 quack. But it could be, and I could be flat out wrong. It's happened before. Anyway, I have a question about near death, but thank you. You're probably right, because when I'm drawing on a whole slew of memories over 40 years, I sometimes fuse them. You know, my little neurons go, I'm tired. they start talking, whatever. Anyway, I have a question about near-death experiences. The woman whose story you shared yesterday reported that when she died, she was drawn toward a white light and was greeted by deceased family members, people she knew, and others whom she didn't know. It was her uncle, she says, who gave her a push back into her body. Yeah, because she didn't want to come back. And when she was coming back, she found it was really unpleasant. It was like coming back into a cold pool of water. That's what she described. Now, at that time, her body temperature probably wasn't back up to 98.6 Fahrenheit. So it might literally have been quite cold coming back into that very, very cooled off body. Yeah, these are some of the details I knew about. I didn't share everything I knew about it. And so does this account fit with the Buddhist view of the bardo? In other words, according to Buddhism, can one meet family members who are long deceased in the bardo, as many death experiencers have claimed? It's an interesting question. I've encountered it before. You look at Bruce Grayson's work and so forth. And then, of course, the whole thing, which I have not taken a lot of interest in, but I also don't simply discount it, and that is mediums. Mediums, you know, going back to the time of William James and probably before, that will go into a trance and then they'll let you talk with deceased relatives. That's been going on a long time. And so it clearly that doesn't fit neatly into the Buddhist account, where overall the bardo is a very transitional phase. It doesn't last a very long time. And then your uncle is now walking around like a chicken because he is a chicken, you know. Or he's a little girl living in Alabama or something else, but is no longer your uncle. His uncle is finito and has become somebody else, you know. And so it's these experiences, and, you know, it's from multiple sources, it's much more like the Confucian notion. And a central theme of Confucianism is that your ancestors up there, and a major thing you have to do is you honor your ancestors and you keep on making offerings to them, and you honor them because they're all waiting for you, and you're going to go join your ancestors when you die. So you can imagine, and that is a very ancient tradition in China. So when Buddhism came to China something like 2,000 years ago or so, very, very roughly, you can see this would be a very major difference. Here, for a couple of thousand years already, they'd been worshiping their ancestors, and then suddenly Buddhism says your ancestors are now chickens and dogs and hell beings and predators, and so what are you worshiping them for, you know? And so that was certainly, I'm sure that took some sifting. That took some sifting there. And so some simply converted to Buddhism, some warded Buddhism off. And what I've heard about Chinese Buddhism, you can see how deftly I'm trying to avoid the question, is that I've heard this said before the Chinese, you know, destroyed their civilization. The Chinese communists destroyed Chinese civilization to a large extent. That a commonplace in China was that people would say, for my social interactions, I'm a Confucianist. For my body and longevity, I'm a Taoist. And for liberation and enlightenment, I'm a Buddhist. So something like that. And so they kind of sorted it out. That probably took decades or centuries of sifting. And then, of course, having said that, some people, I'm certain, were 100% Taoist, 100% Confucianist, and 100% Buddhist. But, you know, they sorted things out. Hola, so now to come back to it, I don't have a, certainly, I absolutely do not have a definitive answer from Buddhism, not even close. I have grappled with this issue, just ruminated on it, chewed it over. You know, swallowed it, spit it up again, chewed it over, swallowed it, spit it up again, chewed it over. So I ruminated. From a Buddhist perspective, there's just no way. It's just incompatible with every Buddhist school that your relatives have all simply been reborn in deadland, and they're waiting there for you as your uncle forever. and your grandma forever, and so forth. And moreover, what do they look like? Does your grandma look like what she looked like when she died? You know, the day before she died? And she gets to stay that way for eternity? What? What? You know, that really stinks, you know. Or, you know, a little baby that died, you know, a little child that dies. You wind up pooping your pants for eternity because you wind up being a little baby forever and ever and ever. You know, so, I mean, presumably that's nobody's ancestor. So, no, if that's true, then Buddha really got it wrong. Because I just don't see any way to fit that view, that the ancestors just hang out for eternity. And moreover, that they really care about you making offerings to them. No, it's just not a Buddhist view. So if that view is right, then Buddhism really isn't. So, but now at the same time, Buddhism, I think a Buddhist, an open-minded Buddhist, can't simply come along and say, you did not have that experience, because that doesn't fit our worldview. So we can't do that either. I think you'll all have noticed that when you were sharing your experiences with me in our weekly conversations, I don't believe it ever happened that I told you, oh, you didn't have that experience. No, you weren't depressed. I'm sorry, but you weren't depressed. No, you didn't experience shimmering lights. No, 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 you didn't experience pain in your knee. No, you can't do that. Now, if you said, I experienced this, and I'm sure it was Rigpa, I could say, well, let's talk. Because now you're taking your experiencing it and putting it into a framework of Buddhism that you may or may not know about, in which case trying to map your experience onto some Buddhist grid, well, that's where a scholar comes in, and you can certainly make mistakes. So for this one, I think maybe I've dodged this bullet as long as I can. I have to say something. I've discussed this, I think, at least with one lama. And to try to make sense of that within a Buddhist context. Now, maybe you can't, in which case, we'll leave it as a question mark. We say, don't know how to deal with that. And that's not embarrassing, that's just being honest. But if we try our best and say, well, okay, then I'd say, okay, it's not your uncle. It's not your monkey's uncle. It's not anybody's uncle. It is an appearance. It's an appearance, and it is your appearance. And it's like a dream. Have you ever met a deceased uncle when you're dreaming? Did the uncle look like your uncle? Talk like your uncle? Give you wisdom that perhaps you thought was beyond your own wisdom? And so what you're experiencing there in this proto-bardo, or maybe a beginning of a bardo, these are apparitions of your loved ones as you remember them. It would be interesting to see if in any of these counts, and there are a lot of them, when the quasi-deceased person has witnesses, an uncle, an aunt, or what have you, well, imagine... Let's imagine the last time you saw your aunt was when she was 35 years old, and then you never saw her after that. You know, she moved off to Antarctica and lived the rest of her life there. No photos, nothing. She died at the age of 60 because it was awfully cold in Antarctica. Got frostbite. Very sad story, actually. When she appears to you in this near-death experience, does she look 59? You know, you don't know what she looks like at 59 because the last time you saw her is 35 years old. Then she spent the next, you know, whatever years, she aging. When she appears on near death, did she look like she was 35? Or did she look like she was 59? If so, what did she look like? Describe her in detail. Did she dye her hair? She did develop warts. How gracefully did she age? It'd be interesting, wouldn't it? That's an empirical question. So... the Buddhist understanding here is, yes, you are meeting appearances, you're encountering appearances of, it's not only relatives, sometimes it's almost like my archetype when I was 20, I need to meet a wise old man. At the age of 20, that was my archetype. It had to be a wise old man, not a middle-aged wise woman, let alone a young woman. Young woman, you don't want advice from her, You want to have ice cream. You want to have ice cream with her. You want to have a share of ice cream. Right? It's says the old says the old fogey. Yeah, right, ice cream buddy. So, do people meet archetypal wisdom figures in these near-death experiences? Yeah, they do. And do those beings sometimes impart words of wisdom? Yeah, they do. Doesn't exactly the same thing occur in a dream? Right? So, that would be the Buddhist interpretation. That these are not actually other sentient beings. They're not waiting for you. At the same time, this can be very meaningful. They may indeed impart words of wisdom, as people have encountered in non-lucid dreams, as well as lucid dreams. One of the coolest things to do, if you haven't done it yet, then, you know, try it when the opportunity is ripe, and that is get into a lucid dream and seek out somebody who you regard as a really wise person. It could be Einstein, it could be Albert Schweitzer, it could be Dalai Lama, it could be Nagarjuna, anybody you like, seek out such a person. And how you do it is by anticipation. Stephen LeBerge and I have had conversations about this, and he's taught this kind of thing a lot. But here's how you can do it. So let's say it's just Einstein, who was not only brilliant, but he was also quite wise in many respects, cruising along in your lucid dream, and then just suddenly you get in your mind, I'd love to meet Einstein. In fact, I just read 10 questions posed to Stephen Hawking, and one of the questions was, if you could meet Einstein, what would you ask him? What would you ask him? And I can tell you the answer. Why didn't you believe in black holes? Einstein refuted black holes. He said, no, it wouldn't happen. There'd be an explosion and the black hole wouldn't happen. But see, I said, I want to ask him that because it completely comes out of his own equations, general relativity equations. They should be present, theoretically completely feasible. And Einstein always resisted it. And I said, I'd want to ask him, why did you resist it? Why did you assume there must be an explosion and the black hole would obliterate? Why couldn't you just accept? I would want to ask him that. Okay? Well, imagine you're Stephen Hawking, and you've just entered into a lucid dream. Yeah. Einstein died in 1955, so we're a little bit late to catch him. But here's what Stephen LeBerge would say to Stephen Hawking. You're walking along Main Street in Cincinnati, and then suddenly occurs to you, I would really like to ask Einstein that question. Then sow this seed in your mind. Ah. But as a matter of fact, I'm quite sure Einstein lives right down the road to the right. I'm quite sure, yeah, he lives right down to the right. There's a red door there, and I think that's where he's gone into retirement. Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Let's go see. And you take a right, you go down the street, you look for a house with a red door. There is one, and you notice, lo and behold, there's a plaque saying Einstein lives here. You can really, it's the placebo effect, the subject expectancy effect. But now you're creating a whole reality for yourself, and you knock on the door and said, I'm sure he's home. He wouldn't be out. And you open up, and there he is, this. Oh. I'm working on it. And, yes, may I help you? What do you want? Oh, Stephen Hawking, I've heard of you. What do you want? And then ask him. Now, Einstein, your Einstein in your dream, will very likely answer your question, unless he just says, that's a very stupid question. But he may very well answer your question. Will he give the same answer that Einstein would have given had you been able to meet him 70 years ago? No guarantee there at all, because this Einstein's a figment of your imagination. Informed by, Stephen Hawking, I'm sure, knows a lot about Albert Einstein, his life, let alone his theory, probably totally mastered his theory, and I'm sure he knows a lot about his life, even I do. So the words that Einstein would give him would be very feasible. But would they be what Albert actually would have said? Well, there's just no telling. So that would be the Buddhist interpretation. That's a Buddhist interpretation. Okay? So, and who knows? Maybe that's why, because people have been having near-death experiences for a lot longer than modern medicine, maybe that's the basis of the whole Confucianist deal. People had a lot of near-death experiences, met their relatives, and then they didn't die, and they said, hey, Mom and Dad are waiting for me. You know, who knows? That's just speculation. Ah.
What about mediums?
I'm not going to answer that one. I've got these one beat you in the queue. They beat you in the queue. So here are two photos, especially for people on podcast. One is two, I will say two. It's maybe a 12-year-old girl's body. The body looks broad at the top, but down is, well, pretty broad, but it has two legs, two arms, but two necks and two seemingly very happy heads of girls. So two-headed girl, okay? And the other one is a single head of a cat with two full-fledged bodies going out to the side. So looks like probably, I don't know, I can't count the number of legs, but it looks like two full cat bodies streaming from the side, but with one cat head in the middle. Is it, and it's, oh, it says here, two hearts and one brain for the cat. It's got one head. And then quite obviously for these two girls, I will say, one heart and two brains. So this is a question about the relationship between brain and consciousness. If the substrate consciousness does not depend on the brain, is not dependent upon the brain, then how many substrate consciousness are there in each of these organisms? One and two. Sure. 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 Well, for the girls, I would ask both of the girls to achieve shamatha. See. And then ask them, right? Bear in mind, for the cat and for, I will say, these two girls, it's two heads, and this kind of Siamese twins have been around for a long time, and they will have conversations with them, and they will disagree with each other and get angry at each other and love each other and so forth and so on. And so it's very obvious, I think, with no speculation, that there are two sentient beings there, right? And so it's a very peculiar kind of karma, two sentient beings, but encased within one skin, and two brains. So there's no question, even from a Buddhist perspective, and again, Buddhists do not have any elaborate theory of the brain at all that I've ever seen. Nevertheless, there's just no question, even if Buddhists, well, just there's no question. Brain functioning is very powerfully correlated to the functioning of the coarse mind. There's just no question about that. And so two brains would suggest two coarse minds, right? And that if it's two coarse minds, then it really does imply two substrate consciousnesses from which they are emerging. Okay? So, and moreover, in many cases, Siamese twins can indeed, with the fantastic technology of modern surgery, they've been able to be separated and be, you know, and then they really are quite clearly two individuals. And so that would be the case for Siamese twins. Here's a cat with one head, two bodies, and what does it say? Two hearts and one brain. Once again, coarse mind. I don't know. Number two, my strong speculation would be this is one sentient being with a very weird body and therefore having one substrate consciousness. What pattern of reincarnation might they follow? Well, in case of the cat, it's one sentient being. In case of the two girls, two continua accumulating their own karma when this life is over, or they're, in this case, I can't even imagine a surgery. And if you can see this photo, there's going to be not surgery for this. It's just two heads on one body. So there's just no way. I can't imagine it. But if it were, so in a totally hypothetical world, if those two girls could be split, then you would have two girls and they would both be incarnated separately. But when this, certainly when one dies, I think in terms biologically, medically speaking, if either of these girls in the same body, if either one dies, the other one is going to die really quickly. You'll not have a dead head. That doesn't happen. So they're going to die pretty much the same. And then they'll just be separated and they'll go off into their own future rebirths. But I wanted, so there it is. That's my best shot on that one. But something I thought about for years now, not deeply, but just more like a very lackadaisical cow with not much to do, chewing cud. Worms, earthworms. I have a knowledge of an earthworm like pretty much any 10-year-old kid has a knowledge of an earthworm. Nothing more. I've never studied them. And I'm sure many people have. Some people probably made a life's work of studying worms. But from what I knew, and it's still my knowledge from being a 10-year-old, when for a little while I fished back then, and it was pretty clear you cut a worm in half, and as my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong even on this point, because I'm talking about 10-year-old knowledge, if you cut a worm, like a nice long worm that's 6 inches long, cut it right in half, the two not only continue to live, my understanding is they can procreate and carry on. And is that true? That's my sense. That's what I was told when I was a little kid, that they don't just wiggle around for a while and then one dies or they both die. But my understanding is, does anybody know? From an authoritative source? Because I'm not speaking from any authoritative source at all. They get smarter. Yeah, that could be brain food. Yeah, brain food. Yeah. So, but let's imagine this is the case. So maybe it's not. But let's imagine this is the case because it seems. So Darlene has a study to cite, and I think a lot of people believe this. So if it's wrong, then everything I'm saying is wrong. No big deal. But let's imagine this is the case. You got one worm, cut it in half, and now you got two worms. They go off, and then they presumably worms mate, right? I mean, I really know very little about worms. So the two 3-inch worms go off and find some other short worms. And they mate and they have babies and they continue to have babies and they, you now have two lineages, right, of little wormlets spreading out over the globe. But clearly then you had two sentient beings. Okay, so let's assuming this is the case. But at the beginning, so from a Buddhist perspective, if we're going to take it seriously, and of course I do, because to my mind, it's the most compelling theory I've ever encountered, bar none. What I've been describing all along, consciousness, substrate, consciousness, all that kind of business. But now, if this is true, and you can cut a worm in half, and now the two are going off, and they're two separate sentient beings, mating with other sentient beings, producing babies that are other sentient beings, and continue on, and then dying a natural death, then you'd have to say, well, those two worms look like two separate sentient beings. So did their substrate consciousness split? In which case you actually, the second one, let's imagine that the second one could then get up on his little hiney and say, there is a beginning to samsara. It happened 3 minutes ago. a new sentient being came into existence because I didn't exist. It was him over there that existed. But my samsara began 3 minutes ago. Well, no, that from a Buddhist perspective, you don't get a brand new substrate consciousness by cutting a worm in half. But then, how come they can both live seemingly as independent now, as independent as Carissa and I are, or Carlos and I are? We're independent. You die, I don't die. I die, you don't die. That's pretty independent, right? Not absolutely, but pragmatically speaking, yes. And so if these are now two independent sentient beings, one dies, the other one is not even injured, then how does that happen? And here's my best shot on that one, to the unasked question. What about worms? Having had worms, I've taken this, to heart. Who are these little passengers? How many of them were there? And here's my thought, and this is worth maybe one Thai baht, which is about 3 cents. So here's my Thai baht hypothesis. Thai baht, about 33 baht per dollar. So about 1 baht worth of speculation about what happens to the worm when you divide. Here's my speculation, because it's actually a real issue from Buddhism. I mean, if you can't create a new consciousness by, so here's my shot. And that is, but before giving my shot, the question is, and this is a real, this is a scientific question, and I do not condone the research, and I do not suggest the research, but scientists are not as squeamish about killing worms as I am. And that is, if you cut a 6-inch worm, you've seen them out on the street, yeah? Pretty long ones. Choo-choo, 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 and they're trying to get across the street. Take a 6-inch worm, whack it in half, 2-3-inch worms, and they both go off and procreate and like that, okay? Now, get out your knife. Please don't do this at home. Get out your knife and cut it into 4 pieces. 4 worms. Do 4 worms go off and mate? And then, is it 4 now sentient beings? 4 sentient beings? Or let's make it 6. Bring out, chop, 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 chop. Now you got 6 1-inch worms. right? As I said, please, don't answer. I'm setting this up ad absurdum, okay? And that is, if you cut it in half, a lot of people believe, Darlene and I believe, that you got two worms that go off and procreate. But if you get out your, you know, your knife, chop it into six pieces, then do each of the one-inch worms, they go off and live happily ever after, create little babies, and so forth. Well, in that case, how about 60? Let's just chop it up into 60 little pieces. And now do 60 little worms go off. Let's make it 600. No, 6,000. No, because there's a lot of molecules in there. And so at what point, no? Well, that's a biological question because it's an objective something. I mean, they either do go off and live happily ever after and procreate, or they don't. They just wiggle like a snake. You cut off its head, it will cut off a snake's head, and it's the rest of it will wiggle around for a while. But it's not going to have any babies. All right, there's not two snakes. It's one snake head and one snake body, and they're both going to die pretty quickly. But there's no future for either one of them. Right? That's, again, common knowledge. So the question becomes, can you just divide it in half or in thirds, fourth, fifth, sixth, 600, 6,000? How many? It's a biological question. And there's a right answer to that. I don't know what it is. But I would be very, very surprised if it's six. If you're going to get six sentient beings by chopping up into six pieces, let alone 600 or 6,000. So, with that in mind, it's got to be a finite number. You can't imagine putting into a meat grinder and then separating it out, you know, and getting 6,000 little pieces, and they all wiggle off and say, "Whippy, let's mate," Yeah. So here's my speculation. As I said, it's worth all the 3 cents, and I've been spending much more time on it than that's worth. Is my expectation is, it's like those girls, two sentient beings. If it's two, it's four, it's six, however many. But there's multiple sentient beings within one skin. Chop it in half, and you chopped in the right place. That is, you don't chop it off, you know, one half of an inch and then leave 5.5 inches here. Chop it off right in the middle. Then it would be like separating Siamese twins, that there were two sentient beings there, and now you've just separated them. But they're in one skin. And whether it's two, whether it's four, whatever, that's a biological question. So that would be one Buddhist way out of not having to imagine new substrate consciousness being originated with a knife. But it's a biological question, how many can actually make it? So Jacob first. You people love worms, I can tell, so hands are popping up all over the place. We don't know. We don't know whether the hydras, amoebas, and viruses, and DNA and RNA.
Origins
and so
of
forth. We don't know.
Evolutionary life on our planet start with that.
Yeah, we just don't know. That's the flat out answer. I've had this conversation with Francisco Varela, world class biologist. He's a materialist, but very open minded and quite savvy about Buddhism. And so, whether you're speaking from a Buddhist perspective of a Buddhist who does not have clairvoyance, or a biological perspective, the answer is flat out, we do not know. We don't even know how we would know. You know, if they're really honest, and a lot of biologists are honest. And that is, how far down the evolutionary chain do you go where you can say, this is no longer a sentient being? A virus is not a sentient being. Okay? How about an amoeba? It has no nervous system. But it certainly is a living organism, and it can bifurcate and have babies and so forth. Is a single-celled amoeba, is that a sentient being? The answer is, we don't know. And so having had this conversation about 10 or 12 years ago with Francisco Varela, who knows his biology extremely well, who knew it very well before he passed away, obviously, he said, well, the simplest organism that has a nervous system, something like a spinal cord, is a hydra. That's what he told me. I know nothing. I'm just quoting a man who knows something. A hydra. And a nervous system means you have a sequence of neurons, and they are so-called, poetically speaking, sending messages back and forth. It's like a spinal column. And so if a nervous system is a necessary but not sufficient biological component to support consciousness, then perhaps a hydra would be the simplest organism that has consciousness. Now, is that necessary? Do you need to have a nervous system, something like a spinal cord? Well, we don't know. Maybe a hydra, maybe an amoeba, maybe even a virus is conscious. We don't know. Maybe it needs to be more complex than a hydra. Maybe it needs to be a more complex nervous system than that. So, but there is just a cloud of unknowing here. Biologists speculate. The brilliant Descartes didn't think animals were conscious at all because they didn't have immortal souls. There were medical doctors 60 years ago who thought that little babies didn't experience feelings. So you could cut them open, you could do surgery on them without anesthetic. Even though they cried, it was just a response. Ugh. It was a behavioral response. There were medical doctors who believed that. It staggers the imagination, but it's just a biological response, don't worry. They don't feel anything. When I was a kid, when I was 13, I had a dearly beloved uncle. He's a wonderful man. But he would take me and some other kids fishing. And when we pulled the trout out of the pond, then the kind thing to do would be to catch them, yank the hook out of their mouths, which is just ripped into their head, pull that out, which rips their head more, and then bash them overhead with a rock. That's the nice thing to do. And I felt bad about doing that. And my uncle assured me, don't worry, they don't feel anything. And he's not a stupid man. He's a very intelligent man. He's Christian. Okay, don't worry, this wiggle, wiggle, wiggle that they're doing, it's just a reflex. They don't really feel anything. Bash them over the head. It's a good thing to do. And the idea seemed to be that it put them out of their suffering, but then that doesn't make any sense because then that would be pretty suffering to have your head bashed in. So we're in a cloud of ignorance here. That's the real fact. And Buddhist texts do say this. This is Tibetan medical texts. It's quite interesting. And I learned this from Yeshe Dunin, the Dalai Lama's personal physician, consummate master both of theory and practice. He said, according to traditional Tibetan medicine, in our gastrointestinal tract, there are very tiny sentient beings. They're called Simbu. They are sentient beings, but they're too small to see with the naked eye. And some of them are harmful and some are not. But therefore, in the larger Buddhist worldview, and this is very common, any of you who've studied Tibetan Buddhism, you've heard this very likely, is when you're eating, not only imagine offering your food to the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and so forth and so on, also imagine offering the food to the little tiny organisms, sentient beings in your gastrointestinal tract. Rub-a-dub-dub, here comes the grub, chow down. Because you're feeding them. You're feeding them. But you can't see them with the naked eye. But they are sentient beings. So the only way to be able to settle this from a Buddhist perspective would be to achieve shamatha. We should start practicing shamatha. That's what we should do. We should start practicing shamatha. Shamatha is a system of practices designed to... Oh, we actually done that, haven't we? Okay, then carry on. Geshe Rabten told me about 30 years ago, 32 years ago. He said, if you achieve shamatha and then develop your abilities on that basis, as Atisha suggested, develop extrasensory perception, heightened awareness. On the basis of that, even without vipassana, vajrayana, and so forth and so on, it is possible to develop the very specific abhijna, extrasensory perception, to actually be able to directly detect the consciousness of another sentient being. And he said you can do it perhaps within just with that basis, something like he said. Now, again, I don't have an eidetic memory, but something like maybe a 50-meter radius around you, you could actually detect the presence of another sentient being coming into your field. You're not omniscient even remotely, but your heightened awareness is so sensitive that you can actually sense a sentient being with consciousness coming into your field. Okay? So, that's either true or false. That's either true or false. You know, he's an extremely bright, well-educated man with virtually no knowledge of science at all, but then science doesn't have anything to offer here anyway. But this is something that could be tested. Really, it could be flat-out tested. Geshe Rabten was either right or wrong. And that is, get a person who's achieved shamatha, go into the specific training, and it's described in Visuddhimagga by Buddhaghosa, and have that person sit in a dark room, just an isolated room, and then have somebody come in with tippy-toe, so the person has no sensory experience of this person coming in, let's say 15 feet away, but outside of the room, and have him come in, go out, go in and out, and then either he does or does not detect. That's a simple experiment. And then if it's superstition, it's superstition, but if it's not superstition, then finally we will have what scientists have been longing for a long time now, and that is a psychometer. And a psychometer, the word, is a label for a type of technology that doesn't exist anywhere, and it's not even on the horizon. And as a psychometer is a piece of technology that would be like a Geiger counter. As a Geiger counter, then you bring it over to like a piece of uranium, it picks up the photons being emitted and it goes like that, you know, Geiger counter. So it's like a Geiger counter for consciousness. And you'd come over and then you would have a little, you'd go into the chemistry lab and you'd have a little, you know, little plate with viruses on it. And you'd go, and it'd show you, yeah, there's consciousness, very low level, but they are conscious. You don't expect them to be Einsteins, but, you know, conscious of something like, hey, it's chilly here. You know, that doesn't exist in technology, not even close. But the Buddhist tradition says, yeah, there is a psychometer, but you develop it through shamatha, and you can detect consciousness directly. That would be marvelous. Then we could know, when is this creature in a woman's womb? When is it conscious? All we have now is speculation. From materialists, from Roman Catholics, from Buddhists, you know, Buddhists speak, but what do they know what they're talking about or not? Well, I can't say that I know. I have faith. But that's faith. That's basically, it's religious faith. Because I have no way of testing what the Buddhists say, but I have a lot of faith in the Buddhist tradition. So, that's it. We dealt with Siamese twins, worms, near-death experiences. So we covered the gamut here. So I know John had more to comment, but right now, dinner calls. So enjoy your dinner. See you tomorrow morning.